Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for the week ending Friday the 19th of January with special guests Christopher Walken, Al Pacino and Donald J. Trump, it says here.
I don't know why. You'd have a podcast.
This will all work itself out.
A podcast about two guys. Two guys asking for a cappuccino.
I'm not sure whether that's Walken, Pacino or Trump. You're
it's all, I mean, they're all, they all allied into one. It's a beautiful primary. Beautiful primary. Two guys.
No.
One of them called Matt.
Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant man.
Nikki Haley. Great guy.
Terrible impressionists.
Terrible impressionists.
What did we talk about? What are we going to call the...
Well, as you can see, we're slightly suffering from Trump derangement syndrome, listeners.
That's a great title.
Yes.
And Trump derangement syndrome.
Well, I mean, it's what the liberal side of the track is always accused of by the MAGA faction. So why don't we embrace it?
Let's do that.
Trump derangement syndrome.
Okay, perfecto. This is The Two Matts, episode 29, Trump derangement syndrome. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I think one subject really dominates because we're recording this on Thursday, which is midway between the Iowa caucuses in the presidential race for the Republican nomination, and New Hampshire's coming up on Tuesday. And obviously, we know that Donald Trump, in his first actual contact with the voters since November 2020, romped home.
He crushed it, didn't he?
He crushed it. Yeah. And there's a lot of talk about Nikki Haley probably will have a better time in New Hampshire and Ron DeSantis.
Nikki Haley's is the sort of conservative.
She's she's the sort of traditional country club and Wall Street old school Republican.
Yeah.
And Ron DeSantis, who's MAGA without the fun, is still in the race. And I think, you know, it's fair to say that Nikki Haley might do a bit better than she did in Iowa in New Hampshire, not least because independent voters can vote as well as Republicans in that primary. But my feeling is that Trump is going to be the nominee.
It doesn't augur well for anyone.
Not only that, but I mean, he is going to be the nominee. Yeah. A lot of mainstream podcasts and indeed, you know, writers and people on broadcast, they're incredibly squeamish about the reality of Trump. And, you know, they're getting too hung up in the nuance and the weeds. And, you know, it's like if they were thrown a hand grenade with the pin pulled out, they'd measure it.
Yes.
And ask where it had been manufactured.
Yes.
You know, this is happening, guys, and we need to look at it. So I thought it might be interesting. I don't know if producer Matt can help. There's a clip of a sort of unofficial campaign ad for Trump.
This is what, just before listeners listen, this is one of the most mental things I've ever heard in my life.
It's amazing, but it gets us into why what's happening is happening.
Yeah.
And on June 14th, 1946, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, "I need a caretaker." So God gave us Trump. God said, "I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, fix this country, work all day, fight the Marxists, eat supper, then go to the Oval Office and stay past midnight at a meeting of the heads of state." So God made Trump. I need somebody with arms, strong enough to rustle the deep state, and yet gentle enough to deliver his own grandchild. Somebody to ruffle the feathers, tame cantankerous World Economic Forum, come home hungry, have to wait until the First Lady is done with lunch with friends, then tell the ladies to be sure and come back real soon, and mean it. So God gave us Trump.
So, I mean, there's a kind of a moment of silence as we adjust back to the real world. This is a video that was made by, it doesn't come directly from the Trump campaign. It's made by a team called the Dilly Meme Team, whoever they are, a group of MAGA, Make America Great Again activists. And the key to this is it's meant, it's a bit of background, it's meant to sound like a guy called Paul Harvey, who was a legendary Christian right-wing radio host from the 50s onwards. He died in 2009. And it shows you what AI can do, because it really does sound like him. Mm-hmm. And this is a sort of gateway into trying to understand what's happening, because to a large extent that is very difficult for Europeans to understand, this contest about religion. 25% of American voters, of all voters, identify as evangelicals in America. It's a huge constituency. And they have come to see Trump in a kind of almost messianic light, or as a sort of flawed crusader. This very odd. There was a Persian king called Cyrus who helped release the Jews from Babylon in the book of Isaiah. And so they see Trump as a sort of flawed outsider who's nonetheless helping the pure of heart.
So when we listen to that and we hear like a comically overstated joke, a lot of people are listening to that and thinking, that's literally true. God has given us Trump.
Yeah, they are. And now, of course, there are lots and lots of Americans, and we know Americans like this, who will hear that and think the same, think this is crazy. But it doesn't land in America in the way that it would in the UK or most continental Europe. And I think that the reason that's interesting is not just because religion is important, but also this is a contest about belief rather than policy. So there's all sorts of things you can factor into it. So the fact is that Trump this time held his first rally in this campaign at Waco, which people might remember was the scene in 93 of a
the siege,
terrible
the FBI
siege
and massacre,
and massacre of millennial people under a guy called David Koresh. Very fringe, but further evidence we've talked about before on the pod of the fringe coming into the mainstream. There are lots of people who support Trump who identify with QAnon, but there are also grassroots groups that, again, you don't hear very much about in this country. So there's a massive group called Moms for Liberty. And these are the moms who are really incensed by what they see as the wokeification of American education, and they love Trump. So there's that. And of course, there's the other binding belief, which 2/3 of Republican voters believe in, which is that the election was stolen. They think Trump is the incumbent in exile at Mar-a-Lago. And they have no interest in the old Republican Party of Nikki Haley. One of the things that we learned this week, I think, was that the old Republican Party is dead. It's been replaced by the MAGA Party, which is the Trump Party. And there's a lot there that is alarming and new, but has to be recognised, you know, journalistically. So one of the things about it that I think is fascinating is the store it sets by order. And this is not the same, emphatically not the same as the rule of law embodied in the Constitution. This is a much more primal Old Testament idea.
Well, it's totalitarian court kind of order.
It
isn't
is,
it?
And we can talk in a moment about, you know, some things that Trump might do. But, you know, it's become utterly focused on the border. And this is not just an issue that's animating people who live in the southern states, but it's because a lot of migrants have gone to cities like New York, Chicago, and Denver, the mayors of those cities, and indeed the voters, are starting to get animated about that. So it's a very big, big subject, that, and also a new way of looking at America, which is not primarily through the prism of the Constitution, which is, of course, extremely alarming.
I mean, I think alarming's an understatement. I think it's terrifying.
Yes, it is. And I think that's why I started by saying we've got to get to grips with the fact that Trump's going to be the nominee, because the stakes now are, you know, almost certainly, barring some biological intervention, as it were, one of the two candidates passing away, it's going to be Trump versus Biden. And that is a huge, huge moment for the world, not just United States. And I think we need to start thinking about that.
Do you think Biden is remotely equipped to fight Trump mano a mano?
Well, I do, in the sense that, okay, if I had to call it now, if I was a forced choice, as the pollsters say.
Let's assume that they're the two candidates. It's October. What are the polls doing?
Yeah, I mean, Okay, forced choice, I would still say Biden. Why? Mm. Because he won in 2020, fair and square. Crucially, he saw off the expected red wave, so-called, of Republican successes in 2022 in the midterms. And thirdly, because there's no doubt that Trump gets Democratic voters out. I mean, if the general election, the presidential election in November, is a referendum on Trump, Biden's got a good chance.
Right.
And also to Biden's benefit is that Democratic voters tend to be what the pollsters call high propensity, which is just a jargon way of saying they turn out. And they serially vote. So, and I also question, this will be Trump's third run. The first time a president candidate has run three times in a row since FDR, since Roosevelt.
Amazing.
Are there really going to be that many new Trump voters? It's hard to see that. But, and it is a big but, what if the Democrats stay at home? I mean, a lot of young voters are angry with Biden about Israel.
Yeah.
The poor are fed up with being told by Biden's team that they should feel grateful for being better off when they don't feel it. What if the Republicans run hard on Kamala Harris becoming president if Biden dies?
Well, this is my... I mean, what if Biden, who is a visibly old man, and we've talked about this in previous podcasts, and doesn't look as sharp as he did 4 years ago, 8 years ago. I mean, who does at that age? But he visibly looks in decline.
Yeah.
What if he makes a complete arse of himself in the run-up to the election, the debates, if he stumbles, can't find his way off the stage? You can already see Trump pointing these out and going over and over.
And it's no accident that the Biden campaign team has yet to agree to a debate with Trump.
Yeah.
Which is a massive poker player tell. I mean, I think there'll have to be a debate. You can't have a presidential election, particularly one of this, consequence without a debate.
Well, it looks like he's running scared.
Yeah, and he ran a bait because of COVID. Biden ran what's called the basement campaign in 2020 and it worked. I don't think a basement campaign this time is going to work.
No.
He's going to have to get out there. He's going to talk to people. And you're right. He's liable to make gaffes. He's liable to look pale and weak and, stumble. And Trump has got momentum, and he's an entertainer and a performer. And an entertainer and a performer with momentum is very dangerous.
Yeah.
And a final point to make on the sort of Biden's problems is that the biggest divide now in American politics is between graduates and non-graduates.
Okay.
Graduates account for only 25% of voters. So that the Democrats have sort of become the party of university education, which is fine, but it's numerically not enough. And then you get into other voters. And one of the most interesting things, and it's underreported, is there's a great Republican pollster called Patrick Ruffini, who's done a lot of work on this. And it shows that the Republican Party is not only becoming the party of the poor, it's becoming quite multiracial. Now, I don't want to exaggerate this. I'm not saying that every person of color is going to vote for Trump. I'm not saying that every Latinx person is going to vote for Trump.
No, but there are plenty of
them. And also, as repeated polls have shown, young people, plenty of them are what is loosely called, lazily called woke. But a lot of them are also coming around to authoritarianism and a lack of faith in democracy. So all I'm saying is that forced choice, I would still say Biden, but there are lots of reasons to be concerned.
Let's dig into the concern a bit, because as you opened, the sentiment being that a lot of, used the word squeamish about describing exactly what this man represents. And I think personally, we've seen enough over the last decade, but we've seen enough in the last 2 months to point to this guy and say, no, he's more than just a hardline conservative with a dodgy history. This guy has got a real authoritarian streak about him that goes towards what you'd start to call fascism, the way that he speaks. I mean, some of the extraordinary, outlandish outbursts.
Oh, they're incredible.
I mean, he was calling for the death penalty for the Joint Chiefs of Staff the other day.
Exactly. So one of the interesting things in this is that normal rules would say that a twice impeached president who's already been found guilty of sexual assault and faces 91 felony charges,
which is quite a lot in anybody's book, isn't it?
It's a fair number, would be just out of the picture.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't even be an issue. But what's fascinating, you dig back into the polling, he was neck and neck with Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, until the indictments began.
Uh-huh.
And then he shot ahead.
Because he's brilliant at using the attention, isn't he?
Exactly. But also, he's using the indictments as a metaphor
yeah.
for the voters' sense that they are getting a raw deal and yeah. being persecuted.
That's it. Yeah.
So he is presenting Biden as an enemy of US tradition, of the family, of decency. He's going hard on the idea that schools are filling children's heads with,
yeah.
you know, transgender ideology and yeah. critical race theory and all this stuff. It's a quite accelerated version of what he said in previous campaigns, which is they hate you,
yeah.
but I like you.
Yeah.
I see you and look, I'm hounded like you.
Yeah.
You know, and he said this in terms in various campaign rallies. Yeah. You know, it's you they're going after.
Uh-huh.
That's a very dangerous and potentially effective message.
And he's called them directly vermin. He said, we're going to root out the vermin. And he's talking about mainstream people, but he's describing them in dehumanizing ways.
Oh, my God.
Marxists. He's calling them fascists.
Yeah. Now, there's a squeamishness about comparing contemporary politicians to Hitler or
Mussolini
or whatever. Yeah, yeah. But actually, you know, even he makes a joke of it. I mean, he has said now repeatedly that he would only be a dictator on day one.
Yeah.
You know, he's, as you say, they are talking about immigrants. They are poisoning the blood of our country.
Yeah.
That is overtly Nazi fascistic language.
And they're talking about internment camps.
They're talking about internment camps. And shoplifters should be shot, yeah. as you mentioned before.
Drug dealers should all be executed.
Right.
You know, it's like...
He said to, you know, of General Mark Milley, who is yeah. the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I hesitate to use these words because they might sound tinny, but he's a great American, Milley, right? Uh-huh. He really is. Trump said he should be executed for treason
yeah. Yeah.
for being in contact with China.
He said, this act is so egregious.
It should be, you know,
in former times, the penalty would be death.
Yeah. And we know from the various memoirs and things that have
been. Listeners.
No, you know, I'm afraid there's going to be quite a lot of this.
Yeah.
That Trump wanted the military to be deployed during the social justice BLM disorder of
yeah.
the summer of 2020. You know, so that, then, you know, appalling threats by the Trump supporters to his enemies. Mitt Romney, former presidential candidate, this is alarming, tells you so much. Mitt Romney has to pay $5,000 a day for his security.
Jeez.
So often has he received death yeah. threats.
It's worth pointing out what he was, the alleged executionable offence that Milley, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, committed. He took a call from Chinese officials the day after the riots that Trump is complicit in instigating and encouraging. And the Chinese were asking, is America actually under attack?
Yeah.
And he said, no, they're not.
No, they're not.
We're
not. Don't worry.
We're fine. And this is, so Trump says Milley was trying to anticipate what was going on inside the mind of a president. And in past times, he'd have been executed for that. I mean, it's an extraordinary logic.
Milley was actually at that very dangerous moment.
Calming stuff down.
Acting in an incredibly statesmanlike and diplomatic fashion.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, we all owe him a great debt of...
Absolutely.
But, you know, to go down the list, Trump has already said he wants to send the National Guard into cities afflicted by serious crime. There's this big document that already exists called Project 2025, produced by Trump think tanks, that would politicize all the middle-ranking federal civil servants, creating, you know, something quite close to an authoritarian apparatus. It's very, yeah. you know, huge.
Yeah.
He said he'll prosecute his political enemies, the Biden crime family.
Yeah.
We know already he made a lot of judges during his first term. We know that he's, you know, he would do even more in another term.
Yeah.
He has talked, he's denying it at the moment, but he has talked quite openly in the past about running for a third term.
Yeah.
Or even just staying in office.
He must look enviously at Vladimir Putin.
Right.
And you say, why can't I do that?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
If the people want it.
You know, Liz Cheney, former representative for Wyoming and the daughter of Dick Cheney, who was no slouch when it came to, you know, being a tough right-wing guy,
yeah.
has now been expelled from the Wyoming Republican Party. And she says that America is sleepwalking into a dictatorship.
Yeah.
And I think she's onto something. And it's so easy to say, you know, you should take him seriously, but not literally. Well, you know,
yes, sort
that,
of.
Yeah. That was, I think, a permissible thing to say in 2016. But 8 years later, after January the 6th, not so much.
I read a piece by Christopher Browning in The Atlantic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who, you know, is a very highly respected professor of history and majors in the Holocaust. And Browning was saying that, as far as he's concerned, these are the behaviours of an authoritarian dictator in waiting. And we should all be terrified.
Yes.
And, okay, so, you know, Gary Lineker can't say this, but I will. You know, at what point do we say we are the boiling frogs in this and somebody needs to jump out of the pot and do something? Because this is how, in history, you look back, this is how societies have crept into doing terrible things.
The greatest ally aspirant dictators have is complacency.
Yeah.
It's always incremental.
And intellectualization of and brutality.
Exactly.
And nastiness.
Exactly. They look at the scene and they think, I want to do a data viz on it.
Yeah, yeah.
No, exactly. You know, you're dealing here with rage and emotion and hope. I mean, this is the other thing, which is it's very hard for, you know, people like us who are of a sort of liberal disposition to see Trump as a figure of hope. But for his demographic, he is.
Yeah.
He is going to reclaim the Republic for them, you know, make America great again.
It was ever thus. Make Germany great again. Could have been a slogan in the 30s.
A sidebar to all this, which may not be a sidebar, is even if he loses, I was looking into where we are with the militias in America. And you might, you know, you recall the Proud Boys and all these other groups were very important in the 2021 January the 6th riots. Well, there's a whole new, I wasn't aware of this, iteration of militias called the Active Clubs. Have you heard of these?
No.
Okay. Run by a very dodgy guy called Robert Rundo. And there are at least 50 of them. It's like Fight Club, the Chuck Palahniuk book and very good David Fincher film. They bring people in on the basis of mixed martial arts and fitness.
Good.
So they say to young white men, come here and we'll train you in fighting. And,
yeah.
And then they indoctrinate them surreptitiously in white nationalism, what they call white nationalism 3.0. When you put that together with Trump calling the January 6th convicts hostages, he calls them hostages, and the fact that a third of Republicans agree that, quotes, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country, you have a very, very, you know, bizarre brew there. Obviously, I'm rooting for Biden.
But even let's explore that for a second. What happens if Biden wins, do you think?
That's what I mean.
Trump's not going to just shuffle away into a cave somewhere.
Already, if you look at what Trump's team are putting out on social media, they're already pitch rolling or, you know, preparing the ground for another Stop the Steal campaign. Because there was a tile the other day on Instagram from Trump's people saying the hard left is willing to do anything by electoral intervention to stop Donald J. Trump. So they are, as he has done in the past, and people didn't listen, they are preparing their way for another round of this. Now, America is in a pretty bad place still, at least psychologically. I mean, actually, economically, it's doing pretty well.
Yeah.
But what's scary is that economic, the trajectory being good, is absolutely not translating into credit given to Biden.
Mm.
That's in a way, if you do want to go for data points, that's the most scary thing.
Yeah.
Is that the incumbent president, who's actually been, you know, with barring the disaster of Afghanistan withdrawal and a few other things, you know, he's actually delivered quite a lot.
So the things you would normally get, you know, credit for,
old politics, not working old anymore. Politics saw politics as a branch of economics. Yeah. It's the economy, stupid.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
when the economic indicators were doing well, parties would do well.
Yeah.
Or if they were doing badly, as in, you know, it's the economy, stupid, was a 92 campaign slogan for Clinton. And it was, you know, it's not doing well enough, therefore time for a change.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest problem, Biden needs a narrative. And I suspect his best hope is stop Trump.
Yeah.
The whole world should be thinking in those terms now.
Is a consolation or a silver lining or something to, you know, a straw to cling to, the fact that Trump is such a singular individual that once he's gone, in whatever way he goes, you don't think so?
Not at all.
This is the beginning of something new.
I mean, I did a column last year about Vivek Ramaswamy, who threw in the towel after Iowa and backed Trump. And, you know, he's under 40. He's the first millennial Republican candidate. And he is batshit. I mean, he's a tech bro, you know, very, very wealthy investor who, I think, did this in order to establish himself as a national public figure. But he is America first. He is MAGA. He is full of conspiracy theory talk. You know, this is the future.
Mm.
Even if Trump dropped dead tomorrow, of course, you know, they would struggle because you always need a, particularly movements like that, which are personality cults, you need another guy. But the idea, which was very prevalent after Biden won in 2020, which was that it's all over, it's fine, Trump will fade from memory, he'll go to Mar-a-Lago and die at some point. Yeah, but actually, Trump is a symptom of something very deep and very worrying, and not, I'm afraid, just in America. You know, this is right of center politics for the foreseeable future. Yeah. And if you don't want that, which we don't, particularly the sort of nationalism of it, you need to get the measure of that. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of what's being written about this is just content rather than journalism. Right. You know, it isn't really interesting how well Nikki Haley now does in New Hampshire. There'll be a lot of coverage of it. She'll probably do better than she did in Iowa, and everyone will say, oh, it's a race. It isn't. Move on. You know, sometimes you have to acknowledge that the thing you don't want to happen has already happened.
Yeah.
The big battle, and it's a battle for the world, because if Trump wins, it won't just be America. It'll be international trade. It'll be the Middle East. It'll be Ukraine. It'll be China. It'll be climate change.
Yeah.
It'll be NATO. Everything that we care about on a global scale will be suddenly up for grabs.
One of his three-word campaign slogans is drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill. He's, you know, that when he was asked about the being dictator for one day gag, the two things he said he would do is mass deportation, closing the border on this one day, and the second was drill, baby, drill.
Yeah.
So he's
get
saying,
as much oil out the ground
fossil
as possible.
Fuels and xenophobia. So that's a pretty big signal. I mean, I think,
boy.
So I think, I mean, obviously all that is depressing, but I think the only way of moving forward is to take it on the chin and move forward on that basis.
Yeah.
You know, the worst thing that people who are interested in the future of America and therefore the future of the world, because it is still the only superpower, this is going to be, it's going to be Trump versus Biden.
Yeah.
And you have to keep that in your head. And one more thing, if our listeners are interested in the religious dimension, there's a fantastic book which came out late last year by the Atlantic's Tim Alberta called The Kingdom, the Power and the Glory, which just tells you everything you need to know. It's
brilliant.
A fantastic primer on the oddity and weirdness of this.
Brilliant. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes. And while I remember, I must thank all of those who wrote in offering venues for the Two Mats Live.
It's so good, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, literally dozens of offers of school halls, church halls.
Can't wait.
So we'll get back to you all this week. I'll write back to you all. But it'll take us a little longer to plan our kind of tour of Britain. But we're coming.
Tour t-shirt, I think, as well.
We need a tour t-shirt.
No, no sleep till Highbury.
No sleep to Rotherham. Okay. See you in a few minutes. Thank you, folks. Thank you for listening to the Two Mats podcast brought to you by The New European. The New European is the paper standing against the kind of right-wing, nationalistic, corrosive politics and media that we've seen drag this country down over the last few years. And if you want to do something positive about the state of the nation, then support our independent journalism. And you can do it for less than £1 a week. For £1 a week, you get all of the digital offering and our great new app. But for another £1, you can get the newspaper delivered every single week straight to your door. And that's a saving of more than 75% on the cover price. And it's the best way to support what we do. So please consider subscribing. Just go to www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. There's a link in the show notes. And it'll be the best spent pound a week you make this week.
In this year of all years.
In this year of all years.
Go for it. It makes sense.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, Matt, there was a big media story, or certainly a big enough media story this week for those of us who are interested in national newspapers, which is, I recognise, a waning interest. But it was the departure of Alison Phillips as editor of the Daily Mirror.
After 6 years. And I was fascinated on your take on this, because you were at the Mirror for, what, 18 years?
I was at the Mirror for 18 years and ran their websites for a bit at the end of my career there, and worked with Alison very closely, actually. Brilliant journalist, and will be a big loss. But it did occur to me that there is an important element in the decline of the Daily Mirror specific to media plurality in the UK, which is there is no mainstream voice of the left or the centre-left. You know, you've got the Daily Mail and the Sun and the Express marching on the right and very effectively.
And the Telegraph quite middle brow now.
Telegraph coming down to meet that middle market. And on the left, you've got The Guardian, and you know, which is obviously a very big website, but it certainly doesn't speak to what we would once have called working class Britain.
Oh, God, it's uber middle class.
Yeah, yeah, it's the definition of middle class. And so
it's why the Red Wall happened.
It's exactly right. It's exactly right. And it's also the decline of the Daily Mirror is also why the Red Wall could happen. Definitely. And also, I think back to Brexit as well. And here's always been an interesting take for me, because I've always thought the Daily Mirror could have made a material difference in the Brexit vote. But it had the same problem that Labour had at the time, which was half of its readers, half of their voters, wanted Brexit. The old days of the Daily Mirror in its pomp, you know, and this is a newspaper that at one point, well, its biggest ever circulation was Coronation Day, Queen Elizabeth II. It sold 7 million copies in a day.
Incredible.
But at that time, its base kind of circulation was 5 million copies a day.
Just incredible.
I mean, it's extraordinary. And those copies were read by two or three people, you know, so you've got 15 million people looking at the Daily Mirror as its primary source of information. And analysis on the world. And boy, did it give analysis.
It was a massive force in post-war Britain, wasn't it?
It changed tabloid journalism. You know, it spoke in the vernacular.
And probably it had a, you know, it's very hard to talk about causation when it comes to the media. But when you look back at the culture of after the war, it is clear that the Mirror was very important to it.
Yeah, and, no, really.
I mean, it gave it.
It was the voice. It was anti-establishment, which, you know, I mean, it was the first kind of paper that would talk about the intrigues of the royal family in a very, you know, in a way that no other newspaper would have dared to, because it was, they'd have been, the editors would have been rebuffed at the club, you know, but the Mirror didn't give a toss about that kind of thing. You know, it was campaigning. It told its readers things it didn't want to hear, which is my point about Brexit. The Daily Mirror of today can't afford to tell its readers things it doesn't want to hear. It can't afford to lose 5% of its circulation if they suddenly say, well, bugger them, I'm not reading that. But the old one did, because it was powerful enough. But it seems now, as a newspaper, to be in something of a death spiral, which I think is a great, great shame.
We should say it's owned by a company called Reach now.
Yeah.
And they've just, I mean, the context for Alison's departure, as I understand it, was that they've just announced yet another round of redundancies, 450 jobs, almost a tenth of its workforce.
I mean, they lost 700 people last year. And there was a note from the chief executive, a guy called Jim Mullen, saying that there's going to be no more this year, or certainly no more planned this year. Well, we'll see. The extraordinary fact about the Daily Mirror is that last year it made £95 million profit. That business, right? How can a company, this is the question any rational, sane person would ask. How can a company that makes £95 million profit be in such a parlous state when it comes to its newspaper audiences? And the answer is, it's owned by shareholders and investors in the US who are demanding dividends. So
it's not being put back into journalism.
No, it's not. So when people, I mean, I bow to nobody in my, you know, ability to slag off Rupert Murdoch. However, he can stomach losses on a scale like that and brush them off. Whereas somebody like the Daily Mirror, and to be fair to the chief executive of the Daily Mirror of Reach, he has to answer to these investors. So he's got to keep turning the screw. He's got to keep making a profit. The crying shame is that without that popular voice, the mass market, the vigorous popular journalism, but explaining the world in a position that we'd probably recognise more than perhaps the explanation given by the Daily Mail on a daily basis.
For sure.
Without that, it's going to get worse and worse, and the views will swing further and further right.
It's incredibly bad for democracy when a title like this declines. And also there's a horrible irony, isn't there, which is we're probably, it would appear, on the brink of massive election result, which probably will lead to a Labour government, in which the Daily Mirror ought to be an engine of critical dissent, pushing Keir Starmer the right way, you know, making trouble, but basically becoming, you know, one of the hubs you have to read every morning because it's the government.
In other words, it should be the most relevant title in the marketplace.
Absolutely.
And yet you can bet your life that Keir Starmer's comms teams will be more interested in appeasing and cajoling the Daily Mail and the Sun than they will worry about cajoling the Daily Mirror because it's become an irrelevance, you know.
And I think that's a mistake, but I, you know, it is understandable given the steep decline in which at least the ownership group is in.
The other interesting side to this story is how much the Mirror group, the whole Reach, bet on page views as a metric.
Yes.
Right? So let me just explain that a little bit. The New European, for instance, is only interested in people who buy our newspaper or subscribe to our website, you know, pay us money for what we do, right?
Yep.
The Daily Mirror, the Liverpool Echo, all of their local titles, Manchester Evening News, all of these formerly huge, important titles within their communities are reliant on people clicking on their content on their website and selling advertising on those articles that they click on. And so they are focused exclusively and openly about driving more and more page views. And of course, what people will click on is not necessarily what's important to their community.
And also they are therefore at the mercy of the big tech companies.
100, this is the point. So they've lost 48% of their page views over the last year because Facebook decided not to serve
it as changes much the news algorithm, anymore. It less news, and that's a disaster for advertising revenue.
Can you imagine being in a business where you're at the mercy completely of an almost whimsical decision by another platform altogether?
I'm sure it was whimsical.
And suddenly you're staring down the barrel of a crisis.
You can just imagine Zuckerberg and his cronies sitting around saying, is news interesting?
So now you've got the situation where you've got all of these websites, and Reach is the second biggest publisher of digital content in the UK, second only to the BBC.
That's amazing.
But anybody who uses their websites will, and you know, I'm not saying anything any rational person wouldn't say, they're practically unusable, you know, because they're so full of adverts everywhere.
Yes, absolutely.
There was a story that the former chief editor of the Daily Mirror group, Lloyd Embley, threw his mobile phone against a wall and smashed it because he was so frustrated at trying to use his own website, and it was so littered with these
pop-ups, and it reminds me of old internet, actually, in the sense that it's a forest of
disruptive
ads and disruptive, and you think, is the article over? It's a
jumping around
terrible user experience. But I'm really sorry about Alison Phillips going, and I really hope that, well, actually what I hope is that the Daily Mirror finds a better proprietor.
Yes, no, totally. And I'm sure it will. I mean, it can't get much worse than being owned by American institutions. But I have to caveat the whole conversation by saying that when I joined the Daily Mirror in 1996, I can remember Anne Robinson. Remember Anne Robinson?
Yes, of course.
Who in her time was a great Daily Mirror journalist.
Hugely influential.
And I remember her criticising the Daily Mirror of 1996, saying, so there is
journalists
always
are,
an element.
Journalists are natural declinists. They always say it's not as good as it used to be, but sometimes it's true.
I think now the opportunity for that paper to be a really important part of public life in Britain has flown, and that's a great
That's
sadness.
A real sadness.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
really is. I mean, that's a proper loss, and it's very hard to get back as well.
Yeah.
You'd need... You know, you'd need a very, very imaginative editor and a very, very understanding and sort of public-spirited proprietor.
Yeah. Talking of proprietors, while we're talking about media, I noticed a column by Fraser Nelson, editor of The Spectator today.
My successor at The Spectator.
Arguing against ownership by the UAE.
Yes.
Saying that it's a problem for a national government to own a national newspaper in another country.
Yeah, I mean, Fraser has done great things with The Spectator and is a person of, you know, great integrity. And he's not a MAGA type conservative at all. And I know, and he writes, you know, he feels very strongly about this, that this is not a good deal that's going to involve money from the Gulf. George Osborne and his partners were brought in to help steer it towards the deal, towards fruition.
He wrote it in the Spectator diary piece.
Yes.
He said this was going to be done by George Osborne, but he suddenly pulled out. And now I found out why. Because he's advising the UAE.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Fraser has taken the Spectator to the point where it has the scope to be an international magazine. And to be honest, for his sake, I hope that the Spectator is bought by someone and detached from the Telegraphs, which are laden down with debt.
Yeah,
yeah, and then really there's no limit to where the Spectator could go. He's grown it across platforms. It's a terrific success. Yeah. And, you know, it must be very frustrating.
Let me ask you this question, devil's advocate question, because I think we both agree on the fact that it's a bad idea for a foreign country to own another country's national newspaper. But why, when you've had Rupert Murdoch having such extraordinary influence, you know, a foreign national having such extraordinary influence, the FT is owned by a Japanese company, you've got German companies, media companies having a huge interest in UK media, if the UAE money is kept at arm's length.
But now, are at the bone.
There,
okay.
Yeah.
And also, you know, and this is not meant to be in any way a sort of judgment upon the region, but there is a difference between an American citizen like Murdoch, for all his flaws, owning the Times and the Sun, and the culture of the Gulf becoming an element in the ownership of a right of centre newspaper group.
Yeah.
There just is.
Yeah.
And we may get squeamish in pointing this out. And of course, you know, you don't want to in any way appear racist or Islamophobic. But, you know, there is no doubt that any arm's length agreement that is signed by Gulf actors is not going to be worth the paper it was written on. I mean, they're talking about an independent advisory board. Well, you know, Murdoch had one of those at the Times.
It worked,
you know,
it worked away around that.
I mean, that
easily,
didn't, you know, exactly. So yeah. I think that this is a really interesting test case, because the Barclay brothers, or the younger Barclay brothers, any one of the twins left alive, really want to keep hold of the Telegraph Group and the Spectator. And they've had to go to this debt for equity deal to keep hold of it. But I'm very interested, and, you know, fair play to all the journalists at the Telegraph Group and Fraser at the Spectator. They have, you know, they've put their money where their mouth is. You know,
I have to say, Chris Evans, the editor of the Daily Telegraph, has been right on the front foot,
just
publishing
saying,
lots of pieces saying,
we don't want this.
This is a bad idea.
We don't want this. And so that's why I care about it, I suppose, is that, you know, that's what journalism should be about. I don't know how this ends. To some extent, it's Ofcom's looking at it. Lucy Fraser, the culture secretary, is looking at it. Of course, there might be someone else in the culture secretary's office by the time it becomes an issue, if there's a change of government. So it's very unknowable.
Very
but,
interesting.
But it sounds like inside baseball, all this.
You know, it's not at all, though, is it?
But it isn't, because who owns these titles and how they are tilted and the pressure that comes upon them from proprietors, financial and ideological, is all part of how the political landscape emerges.
Well, let's just ask ourselves the obvious question, which hasn't been asked as much as it should, which is, why would the UAE want to own the Daily Telegraph?
Exactly.
You know, why? It's a small potatoes deal for them.
And it's not a vanity. It's not a vanity project.
No. It's about influence.
It's about influence. And, you know, in the same way that China is spending billions and trillions on influence around the world, so are, you know, very wealthy governments in the Gulf. And you come up against, if you're interested in higher education, you come up against all the time now. You know, you suddenly discover, in a way that just wouldn't have been true 20 years ago, that professorship is founded by Qatari people. And it's everywhere. Now, we need to calm down a bit, not get hysterical about it, but it is something that needs to be monitored.
And in case any new European subscribers are listening to this, I will add the Voltairean disclaimer, which is to say that I disagree with everything The Spectator and The Telegraph stands for, but I'm glad they're there and they're part of the mix, and they should be.
We are the duo that went to Jordan Peterson for work, right? It's part of being a journalist. I mean, this is one of the things that I regret a little bit about the spirit of the age, is that, of course, we should be reading The Spectator and The Telegraph, and when the pieces are well written and interesting and there's good scoops, admiring them. And, you know,
it cuts both ways, Matt. Because, you know, this may surprise people listening, but I get more messages from people like competing newspapers about how well we're doing at the New European.
Oh, yeah.
And they're encouraging, and they love that we're doing well. So, you know.
There's a crucial thing, which I hope, and I think it's better in this country than it is in America, which is, there's still a sense in our trade of being journalists first and ideological crusaders second.
Yeah.
So ditto, you know, I get lots of people saying, God, it's going well, fascinating, what's it like, tell us the news, you know. So I really hope that survives.
Great. Okay, well, listen, I concur with that message. So thank you as ever, folks. If you've got any questions for our regular Sunday morning Q&A session or any feedback about the podcast in general, please send them into twomatts@tnepublishing.com. That's twomatts, the number two, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. And that's exactly what Kevin and Paula did, who say, why not visit Boston? Boston in the States, do you think? That'd be nice. Why not visit Boston and do an episode from there? I suspect they mean Boston, Lincolnshire. I'd love to, actually.
Either. Both.
Well, yeah, we could do Boston and Boston. Okay. Boston in Lincolnshire.
The two Bostons.
No, they're definitely talking about Boston
the
and Lincolnshire.
The two Bostons.
Because it was vehemently pro-Brexit. I'm pretty sure Boston in Massachusetts didn't care.
I don't think they mind. They'd Boston. Be against Brexit in Boston, I think.
Yeah, Boston in Lincolnshire. It was vehemently pro-Brexit due mainly to anti-immigration sentiments. It would be interesting to see what the people there think now. I agree completely.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Kev and Paula, for that. We are back with our Q&A episode on Sunday. Remember our new subscription offer at www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. And there's a link in the show notes. Thanks to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, assisted by Ollie Peart this week. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.